Biden was at the White House, and he lit a candle and also, I think, crossed himself right after. And Kamala Harris, the vice president in the Naval Observatory, planted a tree, a pomegranate tree.
Well, and, you know, that's good and appropriate. You know, like I said, you know, we don't want to have a politic that does not take life serious and does not take loss of life serious. On the larger question, and maybe even as an extension of that, but we have to take all life seriously. I don't think we're doing that. This is morally untenable. What I saw was, and this is the first time I've ever said this or put this in this frame, and maybe, you know, the uncommitted delegates understood this. There was as much a moral gap between what I saw in Chicago, that is to say, to go on stage and promote these values of diversity, humanity, big tent, and to exclude the peoples whose families are being bombed right now, as it was in the early 1960s and, you know, before, when the Democratic Party, you know, claimed to be for the working man and the working person, while millions of workers all through the South were effectively in a system of indentured servitude, and they refused to give those people political representation. It is a gigantic moral gulf that is troubling, disappointing, heartbreaking, and deeply, deeply personally upsetting.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, award-winning journalist, author, professor, his new book is
KBOO Portland.
KBOO's listeners value community, authenticity, and inclusion. If your business aligns with these values, underwriting on KBOO is an effective way to reach an engaged audience. Take advantage of the best rate and audience in Portland by going online to kboo.fm/underwriting. That's kboo.fm/underwriting.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon joins 13 other states in suing TikTok for its impact on kids' mental health. Portland City Council will vote on a $500,000 settlement for a couple attacked by an off-duty police dog. And in national news, what do a Western omelet, turkey chili, and hobby cars have in common? They're all metaphors used today by Supreme Court justices hearing a challenge to federal ghost gun regulation. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 8th, 2024. I'm Eric Leuschner. Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum plans to file a lawsuit against the social media giant TikTok over claims the popular app is endangering young people and trying to get them addicted. Oregon will join 13 other states in the suit. The complaint says that the misconduct alleged in the lawsuit is actually a part of TikTok's business plan. It says the addictive nature of the video platform keeps people on the site longer and boosts the revenue the company gets from selling ads. The lawsuit says TikTok has violated Oregon's consumer protection law. Specifically, TikTok's addictive content recommendation system and manipulative features are said to exploit young people. A Pew Research study last year found more than 60% of teens under the age of 17 used TikTok, most of them daily. The other state lawsuits around the country are from Republican and Democrat attorneys general. Oregon Attorney General Rosenblum said in a statement, quote, "Social media companies, out of basic greed, intentionally design their platforms to addict users and keep them scrolling. The more time users spend on the platform, the more money in TikTok's pockets. Tragically, it is our youth who are the most harmed by these predatory practices," end quote. Rosenblum seeks an injunction against the company and damages from TikTok, including a repayment of profits and penalties up to $25,000 per violation. A new report finds states are adopting policies that make voter access easier and also elections more secure. Eric Tegedoff reports that of the 12 policies identified in the report, Idaho has adopted 9.
Election laws have been in the spotlight since 2020, but despite the controversy, a new report finds many states have made election administration easier. The Bipartisan Policy Center analyzed state legislation between 2022 and 2024 based on 12 policies that fall into three broad categories: voter registration, ballot casting, and vote counting. One of the report's authors, Will Adler, says Idaho has achieved 9 of the 12 policies his organization identified as balancing voter accessibility and election security.
Idaho does not have a couple policies that we think all states should have. It does not have automatic voter registration. It is not in the ERIC partnership, and there's no process in state law to allow voters to correct any problems with their absentee ballots.
ERIC is a nonprofit organization that shares voter registration information between member states to ensure voter rolls are up to date. But on the positive side, Idaho has adopted policies like online voter registration, no-excuse absentee voting, and pre-processing of votes so that officials can begin the count before Election Day. Adler says his organization found an increase in the number of states adopting the policies it identified between 2022 and 2024, up to 68% across the country.
We've actually seen pretty heartening results. So in most of the 12 policies that we identified, we've seen states increase their adoption.
Adler says the federal government should incentivize adopting these policies.
For a long time, elections have been woefully underfunded at the federal level. That puts a lot of strain on election officials to do more with less. It puts a lot of impetus on state lawmakers to create ways to fund their state and local elections.
Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Portland City Council will vote on yet another police settlement with members of the public at their meeting on Wednesday. This settlement would be for a couple who were attacked by an off-duty Portland police K-9 dog while on a walk in Happy Valley in 2021. According to the lawsuit, Jason and Christina Norris were walking on a public path in their neighborhood when an unleashed German Shepherd came up to them. They say the owner was nowhere in sight, and the dog lunged at them, biting Christina on the arm and dragging her to the ground. Jason tried to get the dog off of her, and the dog turned on him, biting his legs and trying to drag him. Their lawsuit says the attack went on for several minutes as they screamed for help. Suddenly, the dog released Jason and sat down near the couple. When paramedics arrived, Portland police officer Jeremy Dorn confirmed that the dog was a police canine that he and his wife take care of. The lawsuit said Portland and the Dorns were negligent by failing to control and supervise the police dog. Portland City Council will vote on a resolution to compromise the lawsuit and whether to pay the Norrises $500,000. Conspiracy theories undermined recovery efforts in the Southeast. New Hampshire faces a federal lawsuit for enacting strict voter ID rules, and college student registrations are on the rise. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Everyone, especially those in positions of power, must do everything they can to encourage survivors to register for assistance, not discourage them by allowing these falsehoods to fester.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says conspiracy theories following Hurricane Helene are undermining recovery efforts. With another massive storm on its way, local officials in several southeastern states say they're already fighting rumors that FEMA is seizing property or stealing donations. Former President Donald Trump has falsely claimed disaster relief funds were being diverted to house undocumented migrants. The North Carolina State Board of Elections has passed an emergency resolution to modify voting rules in devastated areas. The board's executive director, Karen Brinson-Bell, says in some counties they're allowing temporary voting sites and adjusting the rules around in-person and mail-in voting.
And they will help county boards of elections in western North Carolina administer this election under extraordinarily difficult conditions.
The North Carolina legislature will convene Wednesday to consider registration and absentee ballot deadline extensions. Voting rights groups in New Hampshire have filed a federal lawsuit against the state's new election law. It requires photo ID to vote and proof of citizenship without exception for all first-time voters. Henry Clementowicz with the ACLU of New Hampshire says the way the law's written is ripe for abuse and profiling. He says anyone could have their right to vote challenged and have a hard time defending it.
There's a theoretical right of appeal to the Superior Court. It costs over $200 They're not open as late as the polls are on Election Day. It can take hours if you're lucky.
The law does not take effect until after next month's election. A similar bill in Kansas was struck down by a federal judge in 2018. Turnout among young people may be high this year, despite efforts in some states to make it harder for students to vote using college IDs. More than two-thirds of college students voted in 2020, while it was closer to half in the previous presidential election. And John Marcus with the Hechinger Report says registrations have soared, motivated by questions including abortion and guns.
They're being compelled to vote by a lot of issues they've also grown up around. This is the generation that grew up with mass shootings in schools.
Vote.org says it registered a record 800,000 voters under 35. New Yorkers will vote on the state's Equal Rights Amendment next month. Proposition 1 enshrines protections against discrimination and puts abortion rights into the state's constitution. Sasha Ahuja is with New Yorkers for Equal Rights.
New Yorkers are looking at the states that have rolled back access to reproductive health care and abortion. 22 states in total.
I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The U.S. Supreme Court heard a case today against the federal government's ability to regulate ghost guns. Ghost guns are difficult to trace weapons that can be 3D printed at home or ordered in a kit online, and they've been increasingly found at crime scenes. Some 20,000 ghost guns were found by law enforcement in 2021, compared to just 4,000 a few years earlier. The Biden administration made a rule that companies must treat ghost guns like firearms and add serial numbers, run background checks, and make sure the buyers are older than 21. The Supreme Court heard a challenge not to the rule directly, but to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives' ability to make the rule. Observers say the Supreme Court seems likely to uphold the rule. Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Amy Coney Barrett sided with the liberal justices when the rule was originally challenged before it went into effect. This time, the justices questioned whether the ghost gun kits were close enough to a functional weapon to be regulated as a gun. Justice Samuel Alito likened them to eggs, pepper, and ham, ingredients to a Western omelet, but not a Western omelet on its own. Justice Barrett compared it to a meal kit to make turkey chili, specifically containing everything to make a specific meal. Chief Justice Roberts was reportedly unmoved by a comparison to a hobbyist building miniatures of classic cars. The final ruling on the ghost gun regulation is expected in the coming months. The Washington State Department of Natural Resources is offering native firefighting training to tribes. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Washington's Department of Natural Resources is reaching out to tribes to offer firefighter training to tribal members. Spokane Public Radio's Steve Jackson reports.
In recent years, major wildfires have raged on Native American reservations in Washington, notably on the Colville on the east side and the Quinault on the west. While some tribes have a number of trained firefighters, many others need that kind of expertise. A new initiative will use $800,000 in state money to offer training at various levels of firefighting experience, from basic levels to that of a fire boss. Angie Lane of DNR's Wildland Fire Management Division says the funding will help pay for more than just the courses themselves.
You know, having this scholarship that pays their way, if you will, you know, their travel, their time away from home, and tuition, whatever else might be involved, that's kind of wrapped up in that scholarship.
DNR is also partnering with WSU Extension Service to introduce tribal members to fire suppression and prescribed fires as fire management techniques. In-person courses will begin in the spring, but online courses will be offered this fall. Interested people can contact the Washington Department of Natural Resources. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
The Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Forest Service have released their final plan for managing Bears Ears National Monument in southeast Utah. It's after years of collaboration between the agencies and tribes. KUER's David Kondos reports for the Mountain West News Bureau.
The proposed plan is based on one of the five alternatives the agencies released this spring during the public comment period. It would allow camping, but ban recreational shooting. And it requires permits to access certain areas, like Arch Canyon and Moon House. It also slightly reduces the land open to livestock grazing, and it leaves more than 1,000 miles of roads open to off-highway vehicle use, but requires OHVs to stay on designated routes. Overall, the plan leaves a majority of the monument as undeveloped wilderness areas. Now there's a 30-day protest period, where anyone who previously submitted public comment can raise their issues again if they felt they weren't addressed. For KUER News, I'm David Kondos in St. George.
The Nez Perce tribe in Idaho released a statement Monday regarding an incident at a recent candidate forum. Republican state lawmaker Dan Forum reportedly told Democratic candidate Trish Carter Goodhart to go back where you came from. Carter Goodhart is Nez Perce. In the statement, the Nez Perce tribe said it's extremely disheartened to hear about the incident and says the Nez Perce tribe has called this area home for tens of thousands of years. The statement goes on to talk about the history of the region. The tribe says it refuses to tolerate this kind of hateful and divisive politics and asks other elected leaders in the region to stand with the tribe and push back against such offensive behavior. Foreman's comments reportedly happened as Carter Goodhart talked about racism and discrimination in the state. The Lewiston Tribune reports Forman has not responded to requests about the comments, but has stated on Facebook that he made no racial slur or statement of any nature and that the accusations are false. FEMA has announced federal disaster assistance has been made available for the San Carlos Apache tribe in Arizona to help with recovery efforts from the Watch Fire. The fire devastated the community in July. The assistance includes grants for temporary housing or home repairs, low-cost loans to cover uninsured property losses, and other programs to help individuals and business owners recover from the fire. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Robin Yee about the Yes on Measure 116 campaign. At 6 o'clock, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, a special interview with Marky Ramone. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 53 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy too with a daytime high of 67. Today in history, in 1956, New York Yankees pitcher Don Larsen pitches the only perfect game in a World Series. The quote of the day is from John William Gardner, born this day in 1912. He's known as the father of campaign finance reform. Gardner said, quote, "The society which scorns excellence in plumbing is a humble activity and tolerates shoddiness in philosophy because it is an exalted activity will have neither good plumbing nor good philosophy. Neither its pipes nor its theories will hold water." Combating mis- and disinformation about voting is making headlines now, but New Mexico had a preview last year after new legislation regarding reproductive and LGBTQ rights brought on a slew of challenges accompanied by false claims. Roz Brown has the details from Albuquerque.
Wading through misinformation these days is not exclusive to voting rights and rules, but also can cause confusion about health, well-being, and civic life. Since neighboring Texas all but banned abortion, New Mexico has become the nearest location for many women seeking the medical procedure. A coalition of abortion rights organizations soon felt compelled to launch a website debunking false claims. Another round of misinformation took hold after landmark legislation was passed last year to protect the LGBTQ community. Abraham Sanchez is with Albuquerque's Center for Civic Policy.
It's really kind of this unfortunate game of whack-a-mole with these folks where you're constantly trying to address different pieces of seriously false information that they try to put out. And all of it really is meant to just scare people through not supporting progressive law changes that have happened.
New Mexico laws prohibit local municipalities and other public bodies from interfering with a person's ability to access reproductive or gender-affirming health care services. In 2023, lawmakers approved the Reproductive and Gender-Affirming Health Care Act and expansion of the New Mexico Human Rights Act. In addition to keeping track of false narratives around voting rights, immigrant voting, and mail-in ballots, Sanchez says his group provides nonpartisan voter data to empower those who want to participate in democracy.
I think in these times right now, because of the proliferation of mis and disinformation, a lot of what we end up focusing on at this point is to get people accurate information about the election and what's going on.
A recent poll by Progress Now found a majority of voters, 53%, said they feel New Mexico's elections are secure, while only about 26% of respondents said they weren't sure. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
October is Health Literacy Month. This is a good time to learn about heart disease, the leading cause of death in the United States. Recent research has led to new ways to prevent and treat heart attacks, emphasizing the role of vascular inflammation. Adopting healthier lifestyles can significantly reduce the risk of heart problems, as stated by a medical expert. Cardiovascular disease is a major concern, with one person dying from it every 33 seconds. Danielle Smith has more in Pennsylvania.
October is Health Literacy Month, and a medical professional is educating Pennsylvanians about heart inflammation, a condition that can lead to serious cardiac events if left untreated. In 2021, the age-adjusted death rate of heart disease was 180 per 100,000 Pennsylvania residents. Dr. Philip Nemoyton with Cardiology Consultants of Philadelphia says recent medical research has uncovered new preventative measures and treatments for heart attacks, the leading cause of death in the U.S. He adds that for the first time within the last year, a new drug is available that can directly target inflammation in the heart and can significantly decrease risk.
This drug, which is low-dose colchicine, which is marketed under the name of Lodoco, it has been shown in individuals with either coronary artery disease or multiple risk factors for coronary artery disease to be able to decrease heart attack, stroke, cardiovascular death.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, three primary risk factors for heart disease are hypertension, elevated cholesterol, and smoking, with nearly half of Americans having at least one of these conditions. Nemoyton emphasizes the importance of maintaining heart health, including avoiding gut problems through a healthy diet. He adds gut microbiome, which is a population of microorganisms, live in your gut.
It's estimated there are 10 trillion organisms in your gut, and they produce 10% of your body's chemicals, which are called metabolites. And the type of bacteria that grow are influenced by what you eat. So, for instance, if you were to eat beef, that would increase the growth of bacteria which release inflammatory metabolites.
He adds that Lodoco has seen a significant 31% increase in the demand for coronary revascularization procedures such as stenting and bypass surgery. He recommends Pennsylvanians start screening for heart disease early in life, especially if you have a family history. I'm Danielle Smith, Keystone State News Connection.
As demand for meat and dairy continues to grow, so does evidence of environmental damage from animal agriculture. While adoption of a global vegan diet is unlikely, advocates are making the case it would be better for individual health and the environment. As much as 20% of all greenhouse gases originate in animal agriculture. Brett Pivido has more.
As worldwide demand for meat and dairy continues to grow, so does evidence showing animal agriculture, as currently practiced, is harming the environment. Advocates are making the case that widespread adoption of a vegan diet, one that avoids animal products, would be better for individual health and the environment. It's estimated that between 11 and 20% of all greenhouse gas emissions worldwide come from animal agriculture, and that livestock grazing has degraded upwards of 20% of the world's pastures. University College London Professor Dr. Marco Springman says a vegan diet would bring a number of benefits.
Adoption of a completely plant-based or vegan diet has many health, environmental, and even cost benefits. And if more people adopted such a diet, would result in general benefits for climate change, land use, as well as population health.
Veganism has attracted more attention in recent years thanks in part to advancements in lab-grown meat technology. However, it's still not a very popular diet, with surveys indicating fewer than 5% are vegan. The prospect of billions of people deciding to eliminate animal products from their diet seems unlikely. Feeding a vegan world would require growing many more plants than we do now. But Springman says there is enough cropland to meet the nutritional needs of the Earth's population through plants alone.
At the moment, we feed about a third of all grains to livestock, which means that if we wouldn't have so much livestock anymore, we actually would have lots of cropland available to grow other things, in addition to not having, for example, all this need for pastures anymore.
He says if we shifted to a healthy plant-based diet, then we would still have a net reduction in global cropland use of about 10%. Benefits of a global vegan diet include an estimated 3 billion hectares of land freed up for other purposes and a 6 billion ton reduction of greenhouse gas emissions annually. It's also estimated that more than 2 million additional hectares of tropical rainforest would be preserved each year. Springman says another benefit is cost.
If you recompose your diet to something that is not made up of those processed products but is just generally healthy, then we calculated that purely on the cost of ingredients, a plant-based diet might actually be much cheaper, up to like a quarter or even a third in high-income countries.
This story is based on original reporting by Seth Milstein at Sentient. For Maryland News Connection, I'm Brett Pivato.
As Israel's offensive in Lebanon continues, Iran has struck back with missiles, but has also urged restraint on its proxies. One observer notes, now would be the time for an Israeli peace initiative, but the Netanyahu government seems intent on destroying its enemies and occupying more land. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. In the wake of Israel's assassination of Hezbollah's longtime leader, Hassan Nasrallah, Israel's ongoing air and ground assault in southern Lebanon, and Iran's missile barrage on Israel, the next big question in the Middle East war is what, if anything, Iran will do. Basically, Iran has three choices. It can begin striking high-profile Israeli targets on a regular basis, it can refrain from doing anything beyond condemnation of Israel, or it can encourage the various pro-Iran militias in the region, the so-called Axis of Resistance, to respond as they see fit. At the moment, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei seems to have decided along the lines of the third option. The Times reports that the Ayatollah, while mourning his friend Nasrallah, quote, instead of lashing out at Israel, issued two restrained statements praising Nasrallah as a leading figure in the Muslim world and the network known as the Axis of Resistance, and saying that Iran would stand by Hezbollah. But standing by evidently doesn't mean continuing the tit-for-tat exchanges of fire with Israel. At a public sermon October 4, the Ayatollah said, quote, what our armed forces did was the least punishment they could do against Israel. What is logical and rational will be done at the right time and will be done again in the future if necessary, unquote. Those words indicate a pause in any further Iranian action against Israel. Accordingly, according to the Times, since Nasrallah's death, the commanders of two armed groups in Iraq have told the Times that they had received no instructions from Iran on how to respond. Speaking on the condition of anonymity, so as not to anger their patron, one said that everyone was still in shock at Mr. Nasrallah's killing. If the Ayatollah's position is as reported, these groups will be more than shocked. Being told they're essentially on their own is equivalent to being cast adrift. As with Hezbollah, they may have trouble regrouping and recruiting, let alone carrying out some kind of strike on Israeli territory. There is no thought in the Israeli leadership of using the opportunity of disruption in the enemy camp to seek a diplomatic breakthrough, such as by calling for a ceasefire and a new round of talks with Palestinian leaders. In fact, according to Lebanon's foreign minister, Nasrallah communicated to Israel via Washington that Hamas accepted a ceasefire just a few days before the Israeli strike that killed him. On October 4th, moreover, Iran's foreign minister is reported to have also made a ceasefire proposal. Quote, we support efforts to achieve a ceasefire that includes, first, respect for the rights of the Lebanese people and acceptance of Hezbollah's resistance, and second, a ceasefire to be proclaimed simultaneously with a ceasefire in Gaza. But Prime Minister Netanyahu's and the far-right strategy is winner-take-all. Destroy Hezbollah, eliminate Hamas, and expand Israel's security zone by taking over the occupied territories in the West Bank and Gaza, and, who knows, perhaps even a border area in Lebanese territory. The Biden administration is abetting that agenda in several ways. First, by sending still more air and naval forces to the Middle East to deter Iran. Second, by providing the 2,000-pound bombs that probably killed Nasrallah. Third, by saying it is considering support of an Israeli attack on Iran's oil refineries, though not its nuclear facilities, which is equivalent to giving Israel the green light. And fourth, by failing to criticize Israel's violations of Lebanon's sovereignty and territorial integrity, as stated by the United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon, which administers the border blue line. Thomas Friedman of the New York Times makes a compelling argument that now is the time for Israel to do the unexpected. The key objective for Israel, he writes, should be, quote, a Saudi-Israel normalization of relations based on reconciliation between Israel and moderate Palestinians. That is Biden's stated policy, too, by the way. If Israel now moved ahead and opened a dialogue on two states for two peoples with a reformed Palestinian authority, writes Friedman, it would be the diplomatic knockout blow that would accompany and solidify the military knockout blow Israel just delivered to Hezbollah and Hamas. In fact, Friedman argues, the entire axis of resistance would be thoroughly undermined. Unfortunately, as Friedman says, that strategy is not Netanyahu's. Quote, Netanyahu would have to break with the Israeli Party of God, the coalition of far-right Jewish settler supremacists and messianists who want Israel to permanently control all the territory from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean, with no border lines in between, unquote. Clearly, Netanyahu will not go against the far right, whose support is vital to saving his career and fueling his ambitions. If Israel's polls are right, he has confounded his critics, riding a wave of popularity at 38% approval for him and a projected 25 seats in parliament for his party, Likud. War is good for him. Another tragic element in the Middle East political story. I'm Mel Gertov for the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 8, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tagadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, Roz Brown, Danielle Smith,